content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. Today's veteran is Marine Corps Colonel Andrew Finlayson. Thank you, Andy, very much for sharing your time with us today on Salute a Veteran.
Glad to be here, Frank. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, you have quite a storied past. I read your bio that you sent me, and so I'm just going to leave the room and turn it over to you.
That's dangerous.
Andy has accomplished so much. I'm going to start from the very beginning. What first enticed you to join the Marine Corps?
Well, that's a rather long story, actually. My father was a World War II veteran. He served in the Navy in the Pacific as an officer. He brought me up to be a very patriotic young man, I think. Mm-hmm. I lived in a very, very small town in New Jersey, had less than 4,000 people living in it. And it was a wonderful town. And I knew that I was a person of mediocre talents. And I thought, well, what can I do for my small town that might be important and valuable? And I said, I'd like to go into the military. Mm-hmm. So even when I was in high school, I went down to the Reserve Training Center in Camden, New Jersey, and I wanted to go to the Naval Academy. So I went to the Navy recruiter and talked to him. But while I was sitting and waiting for him to finish up talking to someone, a very distinguished man came in wearing dress blue uniform, mm-hmm. a Marine Sergeant Major named Bailey. And he looked at me and he said, son, why are you here for? And he said, well, I'm thinking about joining the reserves. And he says, well, have you thought about the Marine Corps? And I said, well, not really. My father served in the Pacific, and he spoke very highly of the Marine Corps. He says, well, come with me, young man. So we walked out of the Navy office into the Marine Corps office. And he gave me quite a sale. And before I knew it, I was about to sign up in the Marine Corps Reserves in the 68th Rifle Company in Camden, New Jersey. I went home, talked it over with my parents. Obviously, both of them were rather anxious about this. They wanted me to go to college. They thought, yes, the Naval Academy was a good option, but maybe being an enlisted Marine was a little bit too dangerous. I was really determined to do it, and I also knew that I could apply as a reservist for the Naval Academy. So I sort of talked my father into it. But I sat down at the kitchen table. They had to sign because I was only 17, and my mother cried the entire time. She was not happy at all, but she signed it.
Moms are like that.
That's right. And I to give you some idea of the feeling that I had when I came back from Vietnam and I was dating a young woman. I wrote about this in my book, and it pretty much explains why I loved my town so much. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the best way to explain my love for my hometown is to quote a portion of a letter I received from a young woman shortly after I returned from Vietnam, and she visited Merchantville with me. She wrote,
reading from your own book.
Reading from my own book. On the drive to your hometown, I must admit I was getting a bit bored with your recantations about how nice it was, and yes, I was also getting a bit jealous since I am sure a great deal of those fond memories of your youth involved love interests. However, the moment we turned onto the main street of Merchantville, I knew immediately why you loved your hometown so much. I had the strangest sensation that I was driving through a Hollywood set for some movie about the quintessential American small town. The tree-lined streets, the small shops, the numerous churches, the quaint Victorian homes. I felt like we would soon encounter Jimmy Stewart or Mickey Rooney. They would wave to us as we drove by. It all reminded me of the movie It's a Wonderful Life. And I had to admit to myself that what I thought was some eccentric attachment of yours was, in fact, a real appreciation for a lovely and unique place.
And what was the name of it again?
Merchantville, New Jersey.
Merchantville, New Jersey.
Yes, in South Jersey.
Mm-hmm. And so you married her?
No, I did not.
Oh.
she was a better judge of character. She did not want to marry me. She was a grad student at MIT, very smart young lady. Uh-huh. And because she was smart, she didn't want to have anything to do with me, I think.
Uh-huh.
But no, that didn't work out.
So you didn't marry her?
No, that's correct. I did not marry her. In fact, I went a long time without getting married. I was sort of married to the Marine Corps. Now, the Marine Corps is like a monastic order in many respects. And I found it necessary to remain single in order to live up to what I thought were the high standards of the Marine Corps. I did not get married until I was a colonel. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I found a wonderful woman that I married. She would put up with my nonsense. But I did take a long, long time to do it because the Marine Corps is a jealous mistress. And sometimes what the Marine Corps wants you to do does not lend itself to marriage and a good family life.
Mm, interesting. So you mentioned Vietnam. When did you go to Vietnam?
Well, I went to Vietnam as soon as I graduated from the Naval Academy in 1966. Attended the basic school for Marine officers, which is all Marine officers. You know, they say all Marines are riflemen. Well, they train all officers to be rifle platoon commanders, regardless of what job you're going to have in the Marine Corps. And right after that, I volunteered to go into the infantry, and I volunteered to go to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. They took me up on it right away. The war was on. So they sent me over there, and when I got into Vietnam, I was traveling with a good friend of mine named Tom Dowd, who was later killed. He and I were both going to be assigned to the 1st Marine Regiment. However, while we were waiting for transportation to take us to the 1st Marine Regiment, the personnel officer of the 1st Marine Division came up to me and said, "Hey, Finlayson, you're not going to the 1st Marines. You're going to 1st Force Reconnaissance Company." Mm-hmm. And probably to your listeners, that doesn't mean too much, but it scared the hell out of me. Because reconnaissance companies do deep reconnaissance, far from friendly lines. That's an extremely dangerous job. Yeah. And I didn't feel qualified for it. And I told the personnel officer, I have no reconnaissance training. I'm just a basic Marine infantry officer. And he says, "Well, you've got jump wings. You're parachute qualified. They want somebody down there right away because the man you're going to replace was killed." Mm. Now, again, this did not... It didn't augur well for me.
Not a motivator.
So I went down there, I reported aboard, and thankfully they sent me out on three what they called snap-in patrols with both enlisted and officer leaders. And after the third patrol, they said I was qualified to take a patrol out on myself. I then spent 10 months taking long-range patrols out, which is rather unusual. And most patrol leaders only were in the field officer patrol leaders were in the field for 6 months. Mm-hmm. I was in for 10 months. The team that I took out was became rather famous. It's probably one of the most famous recon teams in the Vietnam War, for the Marine Corps at least. Its call sign was Killer Kane, and I wrote a book with that title, Killer Kane, about my entire first year in Vietnam.
Killer Kane?
Killer Kane, K-A-N-E.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we had a... some incredible adventures. At the time, I didn't realize probably how dangerous they were because I was young and kind of foolish. Now I'm just old and foolish. But at the time, I didn't realize how dangerous some of these jobs were. We had several instances where we were actually far from friendly lines, surrounded by North Vietnamese soldiers, and things looked pretty grim. But we were fortunate to get out with our lives.
How'd that go? Were you able to call in fire?
I give you a perfect example, one I talk about all the time, and it's in the book. Mm-hmm. It happened on the 4th of July, 1967. I took out an 8-man patrol consisting of seven Marines and one Navy corpsman. We were put on very short notice to go out because the commanding general of the 1st Marine Division had received some intelligence that a North Vietnamese unit had moved from Laos across the border into Quang Nam province, and it was moving along what was known as the Yellow Brick Road, which was a main infiltration route into Quang Nam province towards the city of Da Nang. But unfortunately, most of that terrain along where the Yellow Brick Road was covered by a very high canopy, and aerial observers could not observe the trail at all. Mm-hmm. So the general said he wanted a ground reconnaissance team to go out there near the Laos border and insert in the valley that contained this trail to try to locate this fairly large group of North Vietnamese soldiers, estimated to be about 500 men. So the eight of us,
oh my gosh,
both of us were put on a helicopter, flew out there blind. It was rainy and foggy. We made two attempts to insert it, but ground fire prevented us from getting in. On the third attempt, we were successful in landing on a small ridgeline overlooking the valley. We spent the night in the rain and the cold with mosquitoes and leeches feasting on our blood. And then in the morning, we went down to the trail. To make a long story short, while we were down on near that trail, we had two contacts with North Vietnamese patrols. They knew we were there. Our mission really had to be aborted because we just couldn't continue along that trail. It was pretty obvious there were a lot of North Vietnamese nearby.
Yeah.
So we really accomplished our mission. But because they were chasing us, we decided to go back and find a landing zone where we could be extracted.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know of any other landing zones in the area, so we went back to the original landing zone, which was kind of a dangerous thing to do. We went back there. It was late, getting late. We spent another night shivering in the cold and the rain. And in the morning, things looked good. We got a radio message from a radio relay site on Ba Na Mountain. And the relay site told us that the helicopters would be at our position in about an hour and to stand by, be ready to be extracted. We thought things were fine. And then while we were sitting there in this tall elephant grass, a Sergeant Pugh, who was my assistant patrol leader, tapped me on the shoulder. And we don't talk when we're out on patrol. We use hand and arm signals.
Mm-hmm.
We just whisper on the radio, in fact. He didn't say a word. He just placed his hand in front of his face, which was the hand and arm signal for he spotted the enemy. And then he put his cupped his hand to his ear, meaning listen. So all of us just froze. We hardly even took a breath. We were listening for what he had heard. We didn't hear anything at first, just the normal jungle sounds. But after about a minute, we heard what he heard. It was this crack, crack, crack.
Mm-hmm.
Something or someone was moving through the bamboo towards our position.
Mm-hmm.
And what made it worse is we heard crack, crack, crack on two sides of us, indicating that they knew where we were and they were coming after us. If there was any doubt, about a minute later, we heard a sound of metal on metal. And then we heard a Vietnamese speaking probably no more than 40, 50 feet away from us. So we knew what was going to happen. We formed our little 360-degree perimeter. We faced outboard with our weapons at the ready. We didn't have very long to wait. My corpsman, Doc Willis, a Navy corpsman, I saw him out of the corner of my eye raise his rifle to his shoulder. And then I saw what he saw there right in front of him, no more than 10 feet away, was a North Vietnamese soldier who had parted the elephant grass and was looking right at him.
Mm-hmm.
That was the last thing that North Vietnamese soldier saw because Doc Willis opened fire on full automatic and hit him in the chest,
mm-hmm.
killed him instantly. But what followed was a horrendous firefight at close quarters. We had an advantage. We were experienced, and we were on higher ground. The North Vietnamese had to sort of climb up this ridgeline to get to us.
Mm-hmm.
So we had that advantage, but they outnumbered us considerably. I don't know the exact numbers, but judging from the count of fire that was coming at us, it was quite a bit. We probably would have been overrun had it not been for the actions of we had a machine gunner with us. His name was Bart Russell from Ocean City, New Jersey. And Bart had a experimental machine gun called the Stoner Light Machine Gun. It was lighter than the M60 machine gun, fired the 5.56 round, which was lighter,
mm-hmm.
and had a box on it that could fire 100 rounds. Well, he just fired that machine gun in a 180-degree arc, knocking down bamboo, elephant grass, and North Vietnamese soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
That really kind of put a check on their attack. But then they started throwing hand grenades at us, and we threw hand grenades back. Two of the hand grenades that they threw landed inside where we were. One of them failed to go off. They were Chinese hand grenades. The second one went off, wounding Russell and Corporal Williams,
mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that they were bloodied and in considerable pain from the shrapnel. They continued to fight. They didn't give up. Radio operator, at the same time was trying to get a hold of the helicopters that were coming to get us. Instead, he got a hold of a Marine Corps aerial observer. An aerial observer came over and began flying around and said he had some fixed wing ready to move in if we could mark our position. Mm-hmm. About the same time, the enemy sort of stopped. They stopped their attack and they pulled back. They probably were wondering what kind of crazy people were up here on the ridgeline, because the Marines had actually started to laugh at them. They were laughing and taunting. And they probably were saying, what kind of people do this sort of thing, laugh in the face of death? So they pulled back, probably to regroup and launch another attack. But the aerial observer came in, said he had two F-4 Phantom jets with snake and nape, which is napalm and 500-pound bombs. Mm-hmm. And he said, you need to mark your position because I can't see you very well.
For your protection.
Yeah, for your protection, because I'm going to bring it in close. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I'm not going to pop smoke because that's just going to let them know exactly where we are. So instead, I'm going to use a signal mirror. Got out a signal mirror. He saw it. Said, I know where you are. Get your heads down because I'm bringing this stuff in. He brought in the fixed wing F-4s and brought in a second flight of F-4s, and they dropped nape and bombs all over the North Vietnamese. And that was the last we really had of any attempt to attack us. A couple of minutes later, we got word that the helicopters were on the way and we'd probably be there in 5 minutes. I looked out to the east, saw these little specks in the sky. There were the helicopters coming to get us. They safely extracted us, but on the way out, the enemy opened up on them, and the helicopter took about a dozen hits, including one into the fuel line. You see this purple fluid that comes out of the hydraulic lines, and that's not a good sign. Mm-hmm. But the pilot was very, very good. He managed to get the crippled helicopter back to Da Nang, drop off our wounded at Charlie Med, and then we returned to our base at Camp Reisner to go out on another patrol. So that's an example of the kind of stuff we did. Some of them were not as harrowing as that, but several of them were equally as harrowing.
Wow. You really brought it to life, and I'm almost speechless. Now, is that in your book?
It is. It's in my book.
Let me see.
Sure.
We're separated here by the computer monitor. So that's in your book, Rice Paddy Recon.
Yeah.
What an awesome story, and I'm sure there's more like that in here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's by Andrew Finlayson, no D, Finlayson. Andy, I'm practically speechless because that's the most vivid explanation I've heard from somebody face-to-face about being over there in Vietnam.
Well, it is. The kind of work we were doing, unlike most assignments that military people had, we actually got very close to the enemy and saw them.
Mm-hmm.
Even when you're in the infantry, you seldom saw the enemy up close.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were hiding, checking out trails, base camps, and that sort of thing, we often got to where we would get 20, 30 feet and see them walking by us.
Mm-hmm.
The advantage we had is they didn't expect us to be there.
Mm-hmm.
This was their territory. Mm-hmm. It was close to their bases and far from ours. So we had the advantage that they really, most of the time, even though they came close to us, they weren't looking for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Andy, let's jump over to all those assignments you had. Which was the most interesting?
Well, I had a lot of interesting tours of duty, but probably the most interesting one I had, and one that is really very rare for a military officer, is I was assigned to the CIA while I was on my second tour in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine who was from the Naval Academy was assigned to them, and he came out to an area called the Arizona Territory in Quang Nam Province for an operation with these very tough-looking Vietnamese who were called Provincial Reconnaissance Unit soldiers, and they were the action arm of the CIA going after the political leadership of the Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Andy, why don't you do this too? I can't tell you all about it. I can just tell you you'll be doing something like we're doing here today. And he said, I'll recommend you.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I only have a couple of more months to do in Vietnam. He says, well, go ahead and extend for it. So
being easy crazy, for him to say.
Being someone of limited intelligence and thinking that would be rather cool, I said, okay. So I, and again, my parents were not pleased with that. I extended an additional 6 months so I could be assigned to the CIA. I didn't even know it was the CIA at the time. Mm-hmm. I just received orders to go to Saigon and report into a place called the Duc Hotel. At the time, I didn't know what the Duc Hotel was, but the Duc Hotel was where the CIA had all their people mm-hmm. when they were in Saigon. I went inside. I didn't see anybody that I recognized. A very tough-looking captain in the Vietnamese military came over to me, and he said, "Are you Captain Finlayson?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he says, "Come with me." And, of course, I'm thinking, you know, where am I going with this total stranger? And they took me to this villa in Saigon. I went inside. The first floor had nothing but Vietnamese people in civilian clothes at desks, and a rather jovial man dressed in a Vietnamese uniform of sorts, not one that I recognized. His name was Major Vang, Major Lang, and he said, "Well, the boss wants to see you, and he's upstairs." So I went upstairs and waited in a room. I talked to an American there in civilian clothes. Didn't say any much. He said, "The boss will be here to talk to you in a minute." The boss that was there really ran this entire program throughout Vietnam. He was a Marine colonel who posed as a brigadier general. He would tell everybody he was a brigadier general just to get access and get things done, but he wasn't. He was actually a lieutenant colonel. But I thought he introduced himself as a colonel who was really – or a brigadier general who was really a colonel. They gave me an interview. That's all. For about 2 hours, I had an interview with the two of them. There were two Americans. And they asked me questions that I thought were rather strange. They weren't interested in my reconnaissance background. They asked me about how I felt about the Vietnamese. Did I have any Vietnamese friends? What about knowledge of the Vietnamese history, culture, and that sort of thing? And they said, "Well, we don't know whether we're going to choose you or not. We have another officer here that is also being interviewed. We want you to go back to the Duc Hotel, take this book with you," which was a book written by Douglas Pike called Viet Cong, which explained what the infrastructure of the Viet Cong was. And he said, "I want you to read that and commit it to memory and come back here tomorrow morning, and I'll let you know whether or not you made the team." I went back to the hotel, spent almost all night. I went to bed around 3 o'clock in the morning when I couldn't read anymore, and got up at the normal time, had breakfast. I noticed that in the place where we had our breakfast in the Duc Hotel, this other officer was there as well. Mm-hmm. He told me that he was going back to Da Nang, that he had not been chosen. He didn't know why, but he just was not accepted. I said, "Well, maybe they're going to do that to me too." But it was not the case. In came the Vietnamese tough-looking captain, and he says, "Come with me again." I went back, and they said, "Captain Finlayson, you were going to go up to Tua Tien province in Northern I Corps, where most Marines assigned to the CIA go. But instead, we have a problem in a province called Tay Ninh, which is just northwest of Saigon. It's the home of the Cao Dai religion. They have their holy see there, their pope and whatnot. We have a problem up there. We were leaving the man. You're going to replace a person. We're relieving for cause." And I asked, "Well, what was the cause?" And they said, "Well, he was corrupt. He was doing corrupt things," and that's all they would say. Mm-hmm. They said, "That's one of the most important provinces in the entire war, and the agency wants somebody up there like you. Go." So I went. Mm-hmm. Got on a CIA aircraft, the Air America Portus aircraft that takes off and flies on a dime, really. Went up there and reported to the embassy house in Tay Ninh City. There I was introduced to three other Americans who were assigned to the CIA. One was the boss of what they called the POIC, provincial officer in charge. His name was John Steinbeck. I can't tell you the names of the other people. One was John and Mickey. Can't tell you their last names.
I'm amazed at your recall so far.
It's all in the book. Mm-hmm. And they told me what they did, and they told me what I was to do. I won't bother your audience with what they did. They were real CIA people. I was not. I was what they call Sunday help.
So, Andy, all these are in your book, huh?
That's correct. Everything that I talked about today is in my two books, Killer Kane and Rice Paddy Recon. For your audience may be interested also that the second book, Rice Paddy Recon, is available at Blackstone Publishers. It's an audio book, mm-hmm. So they might be interested in that.
Okay. Don't you have three books or two?
I also have a monograph that the Marine Corps put out mm-hmm. about the provincial reconnaissance units, and that is also available on Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Overall, what do you think the provincial reconnaissance units were, you know, were they successful?
Yes, they were very successful, and we know that from the what the North Vietnamese have said about them. Mm-hmm. They said that they were extremely effective and hurt them badly. It's kind of a shame that the PRU were not instituted earlier. They only came online really just before Tet in 1968. Mm-hmm. Had they been instituted earlier, I think that they would be even more effective.
Mm-hmm. In our last couple minutes, who influenced your life the most or made a big impression on you?
Well, my parents, of course, but I think the most interesting Marine that I ever met, I met a long time ago, actually before I was a Marine. I was in at the Naval Academy. I met a legendary figure for the Marine Corps, Chesty Puller.
Oh, yeah.
Chesty Puller won, I think, five Navy crosses, which are not handed out very easily in the Marine Corps. Went to his house. He had retired. I went to Saluda, Virginia to see him after I'd done some parachute training with SEAL Team 2. With really bad manners and bad judgment, we went to his house unannounced early on a cold December morning. His wife was not particularly pleased seeing the four of us show up on her front porch, but she was very gracious. And Chesty spent a lot of time with us knowing we were going to Vietnam, giving us words of wisdom of what good lieutenants should and should not do. And everything he said was absolutely true and it benefited me a great deal.
Mm. And where was he living at the time?
He was living in Saluda, Virginia.
You mentioned it. Yeah,
Saluda, Virginia. And he is the real deal, I can tell you.
Andy Finlayson, we could listen to you for a couple hours, but that wraps up our time today. Thanks so much for being on Salute a Veteran Every Day.
Glad to be here. Thank you very much, Frank.
Thank you. Well, we've run out of time for this edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast, as most of our programs are, after the broadcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. See you next time, and thanks to Colonel Andy Finlayson.